You're listening to PetLifeRadio.com.
Is your pet stressed out? Does your pet need annual vaccines? Which pet is best for a child? Would you know if your dog was in pain? Pet Life Radio presents The Pet Doctor, where you'll learn everything about keeping your pet healthy and happy. From pet care, pet meds and grooming, to pet food, pet insurance and dental care, this is the place to find out everything there is to know about pet wellness. Whether you have a dog, cat, reptile, or rabbit, you'll find answers for your pets straight from the vets, because it's your pet. Health matters. Please welcome your Pet Doctor host, veterinary media consultant and veterinarian, Dr. Bernadine Cruz.
They may be our companions, helpers, even surrogate children. We think we know why we want and need canines around, but why do dogs need us? Do they even like us? Do they need us for more than our ability to open a can of dog food? What do we add to their lives? Are they really looking for a master to dominate them, or a pal that obligingly lavishes biscuits and praise? Dr. Gary Borgeson, in his book, Willing Dogs and Reluctant Masters, offers the philosopher's view on the journey these two disparate social creatures have taken to become best of friends. We'll be right back after this short break.
Please have a seat in the waiting room. The doctor will be with you shortly, right after these messages.
Dog Shelter Blues, the new novel by Mark Conkling. This hard-hitting story lights up the world of animal rescue with engaging characters and their pets, struggling with their own internal demons as they attempt to rescue innocent creatures that sometimes bring a mysterious transforming power to broken lives. Read the first chapter of Dog Shelter Blues free at dogshelterblues.com. Then come along a breathtaking journey that ends with an astonishing triumph of good over evil. Order your copy of Dog Shelter Blues today. Available at Amazon.com and BarnesandNoble.com.
Let's talk pets on PetLifeRadio.com. Welcome back to The Pet Doctor on Pet Life Radio with Dr. Bernadine Cruz. The doctor is in, and we'll see you now.
Dr. Gary Borgeson, this, after reading your book, it just really puts a whole new light on this relationship that people have with their dogs. How did you come up with this idea? Because I know that you have a PhD in philosophy from Emory University, and you studied evolutionary biology. How did you come to this book?
Well, by a very circuitous route. I started off actually being interested in friendship just between human beings. And in fact, I started working on a book about that. And what happened is, as I tell the story in the introduction to this book, I was having a conversation with students in an introductory philosophy class. And we were talking about Aristotle's notion that friends expect justice from one another. That if over time they find that one of the friends or the other is not being fair, that it's important, actually, Aristotle says, that they let go of the friendship, because the root of friendship is justice and fairness between the friends. This is one thing we rely on our friends. Now, what struck me about the conversation with the students is that they absolutely disagreed with Aristotle. They just thought he was totally off base, that, in fact, friendships are unconditional, that good friends don't keep score with one another. They thought that Aristotle was being small-minded to think about it in these terms. And so I pressed them because, you know, it always made sense to me. I was thinking about my own experience of friendship, and whether we like it or not, my sense is that people do keep score. We are aware of whether we think our friends are treating us well, of whether they're doing their fair share, pulling their weight in the friendship, and so forth. But the students were really adamant, and it struck me during the conversation, this is so interesting. There's a part about friendship when it comes to making judgments about our friends, drawing a line, even correcting them on occasion, having to tell a friend that you think that they've been unfriendly to you. It makes us enormously uncomfortable, and it's very hard to think straight about it. So I got very interested in thinking, well, I think this would be a really interesting topic to explore. What is it about friendship that makes us resist thinking about the moments where we have to correct one another, where we have to say to the friend, you know, that wasn't fair, that wasn't good. Or we have to fess up and apologize for for our mistakes. And I thought, well, this is a very interesting topic and a very fraught one. And because I've always loved dogs and have been interested in human and canine psychology, it struck me that a really interesting way to think through the topic would be to think it through in terms of dogs, because there's an interesting and long philosophical tradition comparing a part of the dog's soul with a part of our own soul. And it's a part, you know, we call spiritedness that wants friendship, but also wants justice and equality. And I thought, well, wouldn't it be interesting, because human beings obviously have the same problem with their children and with their dogs. They want their dogs to love them, and they want to train them, but they don't want to have to deal with the negative part of training. They don't like, they're reluctant to be authorities. That's why I call the book, you know, Willing Dogs and Reluctant Masters. And that's completely understandable. So I thought, well, I'll work it through in terms of dogs. It might be of real interest to some dog owners who'd love to think more about this. And it'll be a way for me to think through a topic that's really important for human friendships as well. And so that's how I got onto this. And I still intend actually to write the other book about friendship between human beings. But I got sidetracked for years working on this book. And it's been a very interesting journey. That's a long answer to your question.
Well, that's a very good answer to my question. What I was struck by reading your book, and this maybe would have saved a couple of my marriages, when you're talking about love, honor, and obey, and we think, you know, we have our dogs obey us, and this sounds very dictatorial, and where you're talking about the root of obey, the Latin root, that it's really to listen. So if we were to love, respect, and listen to our mates, or listen to our children, or listen to our pets, you know, what they're trying to say to us in their own way, maybe these friendships, maybe these relationships would work better. When you're talking about, and I see it so commonly, about these reluctant owners, clients will come in, will have their pets, and the dogs or the cats are just literally walking all over them. They have no control because they don't want to break these animals' spirits. Is there a way to really understand them, work with them, and not break the spirit? Maybe you should first define the spiritness that you were talking about.
Yeah, really, that's an excellent question. And it's really one of the reasons that I wanted to write the book. There's a lot of confusion in the culture about how to handle spiritedness. So the first thing to say is that spiritedness it's an old word in philosophy, and even, you know, among dog owners, we talk about our dogs being spirited, our children being spirited. And what it means, as I'm using it, is it's that part of us that desires to compete for recognition, you know, so that you want to be the best. Not because you're necessarily arrogant, but because you want to excel at something, and you want to be recognized by the people that you love and the people that you have a regard for as being good, as being worthy. And likewise, you know, you want to cooperate because there's great pleasure in cooperation. And when you look at history, you know, evolutionary biology, animals like human beings and dogs have evolved to be deeply cooperative. The problem is that cooperation and competition both depend on reaching an understanding, on being able to trust one another, right? So you're not going to, you know, if you and I are climbing together for the first time, you're not really going to put yourself on the line until you have some confidence that I'm really competent and that I, you know, if you fall, I can hold the rope and so forth. And likewise for dogs. I mean, part of spiritedness is, you know, protecting your own integrity and your independence so that not just anybody can tell you what to do. Not just anybody can get you to cooperate on their terms. Because, you know, cooperation is it can be very dangerous, right? If you fall in with the wrong crowd and you cooperate with the wrong people, you can get yourself in a lot of trouble. Our parents care so much about the company they're chosen for you. So it's powerful, and by nature, animals have a resistance to offering their cooperation on just any terms, especially more intelligent animals. So I think the first step for dog owners is to stop and reflect on, you know, what we're really doing when we train a dog. It's not that we're trying to beat them down or break their spirit. Most of what we're doing is teaching them a common language, right? So that they understand what we mean when we say sit, what we mean when we say stay. And then there's a part of it, a small part of training.
And that we mean it when we say it.
Exactly. And that's the part, that's not the biggest part of training by a long shot. The biggest part, I think, is really the conditioning part and getting the dog comfortable and familiar with what you mean. But there's a small and very important part that we have the hardest problem with, which is, yes, exactly what you say. That we mean what we say. And that's where owners tend to fall apart, because if they can't get the obedience, that is, if they can't get the dog to cooperate or listen to them about important matters, they either give up, you know, or they try to use just treats or something like this, which will work as long as the dog doesn't care that much, right? In other words, as long as the treat's more attractive than the squirrel that's crossing the street, the treat will work. How do you get the deeper agreement with the dog? And I think at that point you have to be...
And what if you run out of treats?
Exactly. No, exactly. And not only that, but, you know, I think a lot of people, you know, for example, the AKC and different dog trial organizations, they don't let you use treats in trials. And I think part of that is because we want to believe that dogs will cooperate with us for better reasons than because we've bribed them. They'll cooperate with us because, you know, the way that you and I as friends might cooperate with each other, because we like each other, we respect each other, and we want to cooperate. And I really believe dogs can, not all dogs are as interested in cooperation. That varies just as it does with people. But I really believe many dogs, if not most dogs, can be educated, trained to cooperate for the sake of cooperation, for the sake of friendship. And I think that, you know, in the end is what friendships are about, is establishing trust, establishing a common language, and, you know, enjoying the pleasures of cooperating.
You were talking in your book about cooperation and various species that cooperate and why there's a hierarchy of dominance, and that dominance, once it's established, doesn't have to be aggression, which oftentimes we'll think of one individual dominating another and they're doing it by force. It can be nuanced into this. And it's interesting because I was taught a certain philosophy of where dogs came from wolves. And you say that it's a little bit different, that wolves and dogs, why they split off, it wasn't just, you know, dumbing it down. Here I'm a wolf and I can take care of myself, but oh, now I'm a dog and I can go through the trash and I'm being cared for by people. Talk a little bit about your idea of where wolves came from, how dogs developed, and how it diverges from the typical ideology.
Well, I'm not sure if you by typical you mean the view that we domesticated the dog. Is that what you have in mind?
Exactly. Yes.
No, it's pretty commonly accepted now. It's a recent view. I think Raymond Coppinger, he wrote an important book where he made the argument that dogs domesticated themselves. And more recently, even, I've just been reading Brian Hare's book, The Genius of Dogs, where he also makes the same argument. And it's pretty widely accepted because, you know, really when you think about it, it's just impossible to imagine that we domesticated dogs. We'd have had to know too much about genetics and population biology and all kinds of things. So my view is that what happened is, and this is following Coppinger and Hare's work and others in the scientific community, is that dogs split off from wolves because dogs were a small population of young wolves that became less fearful of human beings. And they became less fearful in order to benefit from being around human beings, from being able to feed at their dumps, at their abattoirs, and so forth. And also just to take advantage of even more intimacy, like eventually the dogs that were able to come closer and the human beings that could befriend them noticed, oh, the dogs will bark and protect, you know, our things from being stolen and protect them from other animals and rodents. And maybe we can use them to herd and do other things. And so the short version of the story, I tell the longer version of the story in the book, but the short version of the story is that dogs split off from wolves because they became less fearful. And they became less fearful in order to take advantage of the advantages of cooperating and of engaging in human communities, even if it's not in a way that human beings particularly want, like feeding at the dumps or even on the battlefield. Nevertheless, you know, dogs are opportunistic, and they got close to us and have been close to us ever since. And then as we got more involved with them, we were intentionally involved with them, you know, we've discovered this incredibly interesting thing about dogs. You know, they have more genetic variety than any other species of animal on the planet. That, you know, this is why you have Great Danes and Chihuahuas and everything else. And it turns out that they're just enormously adaptable to a variety of tasks and ways of life. And that has just, you know, endeared them to us all the more. So we've been able to take advantage of that variability in order to sort of get dogs that are really ready to do the kinds of work and live the kinds of life that you'd like them to live. And dogs, of course, have benefited enormously. I mean, their population is enormous across the world, and you know, they're living the high life, many of them anyway. So that's the story that is most widely accepted now.
So maybe kind of looking into, do they really need us, or do they want us just to, for our ability to open up that can of dog food? Do you think dogs want to be our friends?
I think it varies. You must know this very well as a veterinarian. Dogs, you know, really come in all shapes and sizes and personalities, you know, and I've had good friends who have bloodhounds and hounds generally, and they're great, but they're not as relational. You're not going to get them to be interested in the kinds of work that a German Shepherd would be interested in, you know, and that kind of close relationship to a human being where you're working together. You know, hounds are in the world in a slightly different way. But in general, I think, yes, absolutely. In fact, biologists say that the relationship between human beings and dogs is obligatory for dogs. That is, even when you have feral populations of dogs, those dogs are always living close to human communities. Their whole way of being in the world is adapted to taking advantage of human communities and human beings. So when we actually take a dog and we bring the dog into our household and we start working with the dog, that is the most natural thing in the world. We're not taking them out of the state of nature and putting them into an artificial environment. You know, we are just accelerating and developing an activity that they're already, they have prepared themselves for by nature. This is what they are ready to do. You know, the research about how dogs are better at interpreting and decoding human gestures than even chimpanzees and other great apes. They have a genius for this kind of thing. And, you know, it's from 20,000 years of keeping company with human beings and becoming very, very acutely aware of everything we do and what it means. So I don't think it's all, you know, it can be just about the can of food being open. But, you know, one of the points I make in my book is that one of the wonderful things about training dogs that I think a lot of people don't know is that dogs love training when it's done well. Because they get this kind of attention, they get to work, and dogs want to work. Dogs want to, they want to be at work doing things, even if they're simple things. And they get this sense of, oh yeah, I'm working together with this other, this friend, we're communicating, we're cooperating, and that's deep in our blood, that's deep in their blood. They come from very deeply social line of animal, the wolf, and they are obviously deeply social themselves. So when we train them and when we educate them, we're developing their own capacity to relate to us in different and I'd say higher ways. Just as when we educate our children, you know, we want them to go from being little brat to are self-absorbed and only interested in their own pleasures to being interested in cooperating with others and caring for others as well as themselves and in finding their own happiness in a more balanced and in some respects evolved relationship with other animals. And the same goes for dogs. Dogs really, you can see it. You know, dogs that have owners who really know what they're doing and know how to take care of them and work with them, those dogs tend to be very calm, self-possessed, you know, wonderful dogs.
Well, this has been wonderful. We've been chatting right now with Dr. Gary Borgeson. He's a PhD in philosophy and talking about his new book, Willing Dogs and Reluctant Masters. Well, I'm very reluctant to leave this conversation right now, but we need to take a short break. We'll be gone for just a few minutes. We'll be right back learning more about how you can have that best friend of yours really be your best friend. We'll be right back.
Please have a seat in the waiting room. The doctor will be with you shortly, right after these messages.
Are you crazy about cats? If so, check out The World is Your Litter Box, Deluxe Edition. This clever how-to manual for cats, written by a cat named Quasi, contains more laughs than should be allowable in one book and is poignantly underscored by the combative yet loving relationship between Quasi and his human. The World is Your Litter Box, Deluxe Edition, is guaranteed to have you laughing your tail off. So, treat yourself to a copy today. Available from Amazon.
Hi, this is Tim Link, animal communicator and pet expert and host of Animal Rights on Pet Life Radio. Have you ever wanted to know what your pet is really thinking? Do you want to find out if they truly understand what you're trying to tell them? Ever wish you could build a better understanding and closer relationship with your pet? Well, now you can. Learning to communicate with animals is a 4-part on-demand workshop. In the workshop, you'll learn the essential techniques that are necessary to communicate with animals, including what is animal communication, breathing correctly to achieve the perfect state to communicate with your animals at a deeper level, using guided meditation exercises and method to communicate with animals, and how to send and receive information from your animals. So if you're wanting to learn how to communicate and connect with your animals at a deeper level, visit PetLifeRadio.com/workshop and purchase and download Learning to Communicate with Animals. You'll be glad you did.
Hi, I'm Lisa Smith Putnam, the host of the new and exciting show, Your Pets, My Dogs, here on Pet Life Radio. Your Pets, My Dogs will feature celebrity interviews. We'll talk to everyday pet owners and more. Listen, I am here to entertain you each and every week, right here on Pet Life Radio. Again, that's Your Pets, My Dogs. I'm your host, Lisa Smith Putnam. Your Pets, My Dogs.
Let's talk pets.
Let's talk pets.
On Pet Life Radio.
Pet Life Radio.
PetLifeRadio.com.
Welcome back to The Pet Doctor on Pet Life Radio with Dr. Bernadine Cruz. The doctor is in and we'll see you now.
Dr. Bergesen, you said something that I think is just so important, that happiness really comes from this cooperation and that your dogs do want to learn, do want to have somebody who's in charge. Different dogs react differently, just as people do also. But I think, as we mentioned earlier on, sometimes people are a little bit reluctant, as you were saying, because we don't want to break their spirit. We don't want to be that dominant force. But dogs don't really have that anxiety about hierarchy and dominance. Is that correct?
I think that's right. I mean, they want, you know, of course, most social animals, especially the more intelligent social animals, you know, they of course would prefer to be on top. If you let your dog be on top, your dog will be glad to be on top. Because in terms of, you know, evolutionary psychology, but psychology generally, and how hierarchies work, the ones at the top enjoy the most freedom. You know, among the great apes, they get their choice of mates. That's also the case among wolves, more and less. Wolves tend to be very, there's a lot of variety in how packs adapt and how deep their social hierarchies are. But in any event,
and the dog gets the best place to sleep on the bed, yes.
Right, exactly, right. But you know, what you said, the reason that the mistake that we make is that we anthropomorphize dogs in this respect. Because we ourselves are possessed of a deep self-consciousness. We're really aware of ourselves and how we stand with respect to others. And it's a matter of existential concern for us. You know, I mean, there's a whole tradition of philosophy that's obsessed with how do you come to terms with who you are in light of other people's view of you. And it's existential in the sense that it doesn't, the particular situation or the instrumental value of being dominant or submissive doesn't matter. It's really how you think about yourself through the eyes of others. But for dogs, they're just interested in it as a matter of, as a utilitarian matter, right? Is this other being that I have a relationship to going to insist that he is a leader on some matters? You know, I point out in the book that once you get through a certain kind of training, you get beyond obedience and not beyond hierarchy, because you have an understanding with the dog. And they actually can lead some of the times. I can tell a story about that if we have time. But so the dogs don't have any existential anxiety about dominance or submission. They will appear to have it, especially if the owner is not consistent and not confident in the way they're working with the dog. And the dog will resist and get anxious, but they're just picking up on the owner's anxiety. When an owner really knows what they're doing and is confident that the work they're doing with the dog is for the dog's own good, as well as for the good of the relationship. I mean, my experience, and many, I think, you know, people who are really good trainers' experiences, the dogs just respond very well to that.
But how do you know you're the new parent of a dog or a child? You don't want to hurt that, you know, little psyche.
Yeah.
You want to direct them, but there's so many different ways of doing it. How do you choose the right one where you're doing the right thing?
I mean, that's a really good question. And, you know, my book is not a training book. Anybody who reads it will get some tips on training that are very general tips that most trainers would agree about. You know, the thing is, I think part of where that question you're asking comes from is because there is so much disagreement in the community of dog owners and dog experts about how to train a dog. But this makes people anxious about the business at all. Some people say you should only use positive reinforcements. Some people say you can use positive and negative reinforcements, you know, but you know, as rarely as possible use it. So it's complicated, it's confusing, and owners are right to be confused.
And then you have your neighbor watch what you're doing and say you're doing it wrong, and that makes you feel badly, self-conscious.
Exactly, right. It's a longer conversation to say how to go about this, but here's what I would say. One of the really important things with the dog is that people be really clear about what kind of relationship they want with the dog. And that on the basis of that, like what they want to do with the dog, what sort of life they want for the dog and for themselves, on the basis of that, they should think about what kind of dog they get. You know, even if it's a mutt, what are the crosses that the mutt is composed of? If it's a purebred, what is that dog, you know, going to like to do? And then they should start working with the dog very early. And everybody agrees that early on, you know, very positive work with the dog, positive training, spending time with the dog, that will do a lot of the formative work for you. And then you just have to educate yourself. There are some great books out there about how to train. There are some great trainers. And you have to learn about it. And then through learning and educating yourself and practicing, you get more confidence that you know what you're doing. And you get confident that the dog, that your particular dog, whom you've gotten to know, understands what you're expecting. Because I think one of the things that's really important to understand is that before you can correct anybody, whether it's a student in my class or, you know, it's your child or your dog, you really have to be confident that you've made your expectations clear and that the dog understands them. So that it really is a case where they're spiritedly saying, oh, come on, I don't really have to do that, do I? And then your response is, yes, you do have to do that. And there are thousands of different ways to say, yes, you do have to do that, and to make it clear to the dog. That gets into the nuances of actual training. But I think the important thing is for owners not to avoid that confrontation when it comes. And that's what many of us do, because we don't like the negativity that we seem to associate with that moment. We are uncomfortable using our authority. We tend to react and get angry instead of being cool and compassionate in our corrections, but firm. So all of those things are just things that we learn from practicing and from experience. And, you know, one of the things I love that Morris Sendak, you know, who always had German shepherds and got them from the monks of Newski, in one of the monks of Newski books, they talk about how Sendak said, you know, he has all these regrets about the earlier dogs he had when he was a younger man because he had a short temper and he didn't really know what he was doing. But then his later dogs, as he got older, were the beneficiaries of all of the work that he had done with the earlier dogs and all of the mistakes that he had made and that he had learned from. So I think that for people who really like dogs and are going to have dogs around, I think the encouraging thing to think about is that you get better with practice, just as you do with practicing anything. And that, you know, becoming a good master to a dog is an art. Becoming a friend to anybody is an art that you can only achieve through practice. And that the practice will, if you're paying attention when you practice, if you're mindful and you've done your homework, you'll make some mistakes. And it's very unlikely that those mistakes will cause the dog any real harm. You know, we all make mistakes when we're new teachers, when we're experienced teachers. You know, in any craft, in any art, we make mistakes. And we have to live with that and learn from it and trust that as long as our heart is in the right place and we've prepared ourselves for the work and we're clear about what we want, the dog will trust us. You know, the child will trust. Oh, yeah, well, maybe that was not what it should have been. But in the bigger picture, I know where we're going and I trust the direction this human being is taking me. So I don't know if that answers your question, but that's...
I think it does. Right. And one of the things that you're talking about right now in Willing Dogs and Reluctant Masters, you brought up the subject of anger. And as you're training that puppy, training that child, sometimes they just push your buttons and you've tried and now you get angry. And it's like, how do you get that anger controlled? How do you react to the dog? Because they don't understand the words. Yes, they understand the tone of our language, our body language. But what's a good way to channel that anger that you have for the pet?
Yeah, that's a great question. You know, I think the first thing is, as I said, I mean, I think one cannot overestimate how important it is to sit down before you start working with the dog and learn a little bit about canine psychology, about psychology generally, and about training, and to be very clear with yourself about what is reasonable to expect from the dog and from yourself. And to start every training session by saying, okay, this is what I'm doing. This is what I'm trying to achieve. These are the likely, you know, pitfalls along the way. Now, I say all this because then what happens is when the dog disobeys or does something that frustrates you, it's not unexpected. It's not a surprise to you. I mean, many people go into this without really thinking through what they're doing. And then they react, as you say, they react with anger. And then they feel guilty and they feel remorse. And then they're less inclined to work with the dog or engage with the dog in a way that may lead to more confrontations. But if you do your homework and if you prepare, you're less likely to get as angry. If you get angry with the dog, a couple really important things. One is to really work with the dog quietly, to practice not saying much to the dog. That way you're not communicating your anger vocally if you do get angry. And the other piece of advice I think is really important is if you find yourself getting angry with the dog, and you know that it's unjust, especially if it's unjust, and you're working with a young puppy that doesn't know anything and just peed on the floor or, you know, done something you don't like or nipped you in the hand or something, that you just give yourself and the dog a timeout. You know, that you simply, before you react or right when you're about to react, you just clip the dog to, you know, a post or something like that so that the dog just has a chance to lay down and be quiet, and you go away and sit and take a few deep breaths. And I really don't think there's a better way than that. I mean, I think you just have to, you have to sort of anticipate as much as possible what is going to trigger your anger and try to avoid those triggers. And then, as I say, later on, when you really know what you're doing with the dog and you've had the dog for a long time and you're pals, there will be times when you get angry at a dog that I think is good. Because dogs understand, you know, dogs understand that. Anger from, you know, their mother when they're nipping too hard at the mother's teeth is very clearly expressed, and they get it. You know, they back off. Oh, I overstepped my bound. The anger is a significant speech to a dog. You know, you have to really know what you're
and
doing.
And sometimes you have to speak sure their language.
Right. Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah.
One of the things you mentioned in the book, and I had to laugh because, oh yeah, I did that too. You try to be rational, you try to give them the time out, you know, you repeat what your desire is, and you were talking about your only dog, Actus, and as the puppy, mm-hmm. the kid was just acting up, and you got him and you bit him on the ear, and it's like, oh! Oh, okay, yeah, I'm sorry, you were saying to me, because I had a dog yeah. that was just play nipping, and she would bite my arm and just do this, and I tried various corrections, various ways of getting through to her, and finally, I grabbed her little arm, I bit her leg, and it's like, oh, that's what you don't want me to do. Now I understand. So, yes, sometimes you have to talk their language. They are not human children.
That's right. No, that's right. And, you know, the whole thing about nipping Actus's ears, I put that in the book, even though I know it would be controversial in some quarters, partly because it is, because it gets to the point of how fraught these kinds of corrections are for us. You know, I mean, it's hard for us to know what to do in those circumstances when the dog is really out of control and when we're at our wit's end. And sometimes, you know, a correction like that can work. You have to know what you're doing. I do not recommend it. As I say in the book, I do not ever recommend people biting their dogs or nipping the dogs. You know, you really have to be confident that you know your dog. I mean, you do what I did with Actus and you don't know what you're doing and you could get bitten in the face. So it's not a good idea in general, but it is one of the points I make in the book is that I think this is really a pleasure for people who want to take having a friendship with a dog seriously. The truth is that because friendship is an art and because training and education are arts, like, you know, when I'm teaching, not all of the students in my class learn in the same way. And one of the things you have to do as a teacher is really understand how different students learn and what works for them and try to tailor it to their soul, to tailor what you're doing and how you're working with them in a way so that they can get the most from their education. And it's the same with dogs. And so there is no one method for training dogs. And anybody who tells you there is simply wrong. You know, and there are dogs that are soft and very biddable and easy to train. There are other dogs that can do more than those dogs, but they will resist you mightily for a while, and you cannot use the same methods for the same dog. You simply have to become experienced, and you have to practice the artfulness of it. You know, try different things, see what works for your dog, and enjoy the sort of the play at, you know, learning how to think for yourself and to make your own judgments as you go along. And, you know, of course, that becomes more possible the more experience you have, and early on you do want to stick with some general methods and some general ideas so that you can get some confidence.
And that joy of experience, how do you get the experience until you've done it a few times? One of the things I would suggest, no matter if you're getting your first dog or you've had dogs for years, get the book by my guest right now, Dr. Gary Borgeson, Willing Dogs and Reluctant Masters, because it's really going to show you that obedience training can be a source of joy for your dog. It increases the quality of its attention and increases the quality of the life the two of you have together. Dr. Borgeson, this was an amazing interview. I thank you so much for the conversation. I wish we could go on for hours. There's so much I know more that you have to say.
Thank you very much for the opportunity. I really appreciate it. I truly enjoyed the conversation.
Well, I'm going to let you go. You can go out and do some obedience work with Actus. I'm sure he's waiting there patiently to go out and have some good time with his dad. So thank you very much, everyone, for listening. This is Dr. Bernadine Cruz with The Pet Doctor. What is Actus up to right now? Is he fighting, just ready to go?
He's actually lying here on his bed looking at me. And it is that look of, when are you going to stop talking and start doing something, because talk is cheap as far as dogs are concerned.
Let's get out there, have some fun. Dad, well, thank you so much. Good, well, enjoy everyone, get out with your pets today, give them some loving. Thank you so much for listening. This is Dr. Bernadine Cruz. Take care.
Pets can be a wonderful addition to your life. Keeping them healthy and happy is important. Pet Life Radio presents The Pet Doctor with veterinary media consultant and veterinarian Dr. Bernadine Cruz. Whether you have a dog, cat, reptile, or rabbit, you'll find answers for your pets straight from the vets. The Pet Doctor, on demand every week, only on PetLifeRadio.com.